But let's begin with a look at a new book by Melbourne architect Rory Hyde. It's called Future Practice and examines the emergent roles for architects in the 21st century. Not all architects are designing buildings, obviously, so what are they doing and how are they redefining their roles? Rory's book features 17 conversations with practitioners who are working in fields of architecture from policy to activism, design to education and so much more. So Rory Hyde, welcome to By Design.
Hi, Fidella.
So can we kick off with the big statement, the big premise in your book that architecture as a profession is in crisis? What is this crisis, Rory?
Yeah, look, the crisis, I guess, could be broken into three parts. First of all, it's a very pragmatic crisis of architects today. Our profession is so intimately linked to property and real estate that with the larger global financial crisis, we're having a sort of crisis of unemployment, and that's a very immediate one which we need to deal with some way. I guess the larger crisis that's happening at the same time would be the crisis of the environment, and I would say that's got very spatial implications which we ought to be addressing. And then you add those two together and you get the kind of crisis of relevance, which is that the architects perhaps have lost sight of the social vision or their social responsibilities for society and have retreated from those sorts of ambitions.
Okay, so this crisis of relevance, the third one that you mentioned, you talk about this being somewhat historical, that the idea that the traditional position of architects and their ability to impact on the environment has been completely diminished. So how did architecture lose its hallowed position, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the book, I look back to the glorious days of modernism when architects seemed to have all the answers for society. You know, we had big visions for future cities and, you know, bright, white, crisp ways of living and new forms of society. Of course, a lot of those plans were put into place and they were extended in the post-war period and came to terrible social ruin. It was almost like the point of our greatest triumph was also simultaneously our greatest failure. So I think after that point we kind of retreated from this social ambition and I'm arguing that we perhaps need to reclaim some of that, but in a less singular or modernist approach.
Okay. What does this mean for architects that are graduating from the schools right now? Because aren't you all still taught that you can change the world, that you can, in your to quote you, have all the answers for society? It's a bit depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've noticed a kind of vast mismatch between the type of thinking that we're taught to do in schools and then the reality of when we get out into practice, which is, you know, we can on the one hand change the world, and then when we're working we're detailing toilet cubicles for some developer, you know. It's and that's also part of the retreat in that architects have become kind of stylists in a way. We pursue commercial demands which are driven by other sectors of society, and I think we need to reclaim some of that autonomy.
Okay, so that's where this book comes in, which is a series of conversations with architects and others who span the breadth of what the potentials are of this profession beyond, as you say, styling a toilet or building someone's extension or something like that. One of the things that you do talk about, though, and there are many, and we'll try to get to a few of these, is an architect that many listeners would know, and that is Robin Boyd. And you interview Conrad Hammond in the book about Boyd and of course, this idea that the architect needs to be a public intellectual. Tell me about this.
Yeah, I mean, most people would be familiar with Robin Boyd's work as a designer, particularly through his incredible body of residential work. Another project or initiative that he was involved in which was with the Age newspaper in Melbourne, was called the Small Home Service. And what he did effectively was set up an architect's office within the newspaper. They would produce a new house once a week, and then he would write about that in his column. And you could then purchase plans for that building directly from the newspaper for a very minimal fee. I think today it would be work out to be $50 or something. And that had a huge influence on the type of housing stock that we see in the sort of middle ring of suburbs in Melbourne. In order of 200,000 homes were built under this scheme. So there's a terrific example, I think, of how an architect can engage with the media in a really meaningful way and have a really important impact on the built environment.
And allow more people other than those within the profession to understand and have you know, basically have a conversation about architecture itself, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Boyd is often dismissed for being an elitist and a, you know, middle-class male who's dismissing the suburbs. But ultimately, he cared, actually. He ultimately cared about changing them and wanted to include them in his ambitions for good design.
And do you feel an affinity with Boyd? Because I know you are one of the members, a co-host of a program called The Architects, which is on Melbourne's Triple R, and some listeners might have heard The Architects on Radio National over this past summer as well. So do you feel an affinity with how he spread the word through being a public intellectual?
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty big boots to fill, but in our small way with our radio show, we try and engage the public in a relevant and sort of accessible conversation about design and about architecture. So, that's something that I think Boyd did really well.
Who is the public intellectual today? If Boyd was the past in Australia, who embodies that today perfectly, do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in the interview I did with Conrad Heyman, he sorts of the conclusion is that really we don't have those figures anymore. And I mean, the Atlantic recently did their top 200 public intellectuals in the world, and I think there weren't any architects or designers on that list. So that's I think evidence.
That's a real shame, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one indication that we've lost that. Public responsibility within the realm of ideas. And I think there's definitely space for that kind of a person today.
Mm. And this is where this book brings some of those ideas together. I'm talking to Rory Hyde. His book is called Future Practice, and it's conversations from the edge of architecture. One future practice, Rory, that you do touch on in the interviews is the idea of the activist as well, in addition to the public intellectual, this idea that architecture can and needs to engage with the urban environment quite head on. And one of those examples that you give is an interview with a very interesting graphic designer. She's not an architect, but she's a graphic designer. Tell me about Camila Bustamante.
Yeah, Camila, she's based in Lima in Peru, and she describes growing up there in the shadow of this metro line, which was promised by the then president in the 1980s, President Garcia. And she recently realized that this unfulfilled vision, they only built, I think, two stations out of a planned 60, a full metro line throughout Lima. And she realised that, you know, this is a real tragedy for the city, and that it's actually having massive social impact in the cost of travel and the time of travel, and particularly for the lower income people who had needed to commute. So she produced a campaign of posters which had the dates of where the completion date of the station based on the current construction rate. So, the station in the airport will be built within 400 years type thing, and put these posters up all over town, and created a terrific campaign for getting this metro line back on the agenda.
I think the projection was that the metro line would be finished in 2024-27. I look forward to travelling along that metro line. But she actually did create change. She's not an architect, of course, but she made something happen.
I mean, the fantastic outcome of this is that Garcia, who made this promise, 30 years ago, is now back in power. So it was a way of keeping him accountable to his promises. And the metro line is currently in construction, so they're going to complete the project, which is an incredible example of the smallest intervention. One girl and some posters having a massive infrastructural impact on a city.
Okay, closer to home though, we have a similar kind of example, which was in Newcastle and the regeneration of some empty shops in this project called the Renew Newcastle project, which has now actually gone worldwide, run by Marcus Westbury. Why is this one telling for you, and in particular as an example for architects to understand and learn from?
Yeah, I mean, again, Marcus is not Marcus Westbury, who runs Renew Newcastle, is not an architect either. He's got a background in festivals and media. And I'm interested in it as an example for architects to learn from, because it shows that non-architectural interventions can have a very spatial and architectural effect. So by producing what's effectively a new tenancy agreement, he's been able to fill these vacant shops within Newcastle in Hunter Mall with creatives who were otherwise looking for space or looking to scale their projects up into the public realm, and has had a dramatic influence on the sort of context and street environment and social environment of the city. So, and that was effectively an operation on a legal level or on policy. He didn't go in and repave the place or
So maybe a designer's solution would have been to repave, as you say, put in more, you know, I don't know, different types of design or better, you know, chairs or something like that. But he said, I've got to go the other way. It's got to go from the backwards in.
Yeah, so that's right. So I guess the lesson is if you're approached as a designer to fix up a street, don't just rethink about what it looks like and plant new street trees, but think about the actual systems or the underlying reasons for why that street is you know, lagging, and try and address it at that level. And so it's an idea that architects should expand their toolkit beyond the purely formal or spatial.
Okay. Can we go to New York now with an architect who, oh, is she actually an architect? She's an environmentalist, Natalie Jeremijenko. She has this interesting application for the future of the architect. You call her an environmental medic, where that if you change the environment, it can lead to better health. What does she do?
Yeah, Natalie's fantastic. I had a really terrific interview with her. She actually grew up in Brisbane, but has since and studied in Melbourne at RMIT, and has since set up what she calls the Environmental Health Clinic, which is it runs out of NYU, and it's a rethinking of health. So it's instead of where you might go to the doctor and you might describe your symptoms and your internal symptoms, and he would prescribe you some internal medicine. In this situation, which Natalie's devised, you approach her and describe your environment, and she has various tricks for understanding what your environment is like. So you might get a pet, for instance, if you might be asked to bring in a mouse which lives in your walls, which is quite a good indication of the sorts of pollutants that you might be exposed to in your home. And then she'll prescribing medicine, she'll prescribe an environmental change. So that might be more plants or a different source of water treatment, or for you to sell your car or whatever it is. And I guess it's a rethinking of health to look at the external factors rather than the internal factors of the body.
Okay. This book covers many different ideas and future practices, to use the title of the book, for architects. And in particular, just to kind of wrap up, I mean, you're actually asking architects, and that includes yourself, to think beyond the job, aren't you, to get to the heart of the profession, so that you're not just these kind of passive service providers, but to be a bit more broad than that. So how are you, Rory, putting this into practice for yourself? Is it tough?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to. The next step is to really put it into practice, as you say. So I'm setting up an office here in Melbourne, and we're playing with names. It's got something to do with expanded design. I think that's the key word, in that we're going to, you know, really look beyond the tools of architecture, look to adjacent disciplines, and you know, like history and activism or community engagement, as you mentioned, and try to employ some of the tools from those disciplines into our own work as architects. So that's the kind of big ambition, and we'll have to check in a couple of years to see
how you go. And if anybody has any great titles for Rory's practice, I'm sure he'd be really happy to get some suggestions. Rory Hyde, great to speak with you, and congratulations on the book.
Great. Thanks, Vanilla.
That's Rory Hyde on By Design. Links on our website. The book is called Future Practice. Now, coming up soon, you probably have had a set of these in your home at some point. I know I have. But in the design files, you'll be hearing all about the design of a very famous drinking glass.